We'll now turn to 21-8076, American Petroleum Institute versus Department of Interior. Since I said that, I know this is going to take a long time. I'm probably going to go to the bathroom. You too. Sorry about that.
Philip.
Mr. Schomburg.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court. Peter Schomburg, representing Allen American Petroleum Institute, and I would like to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal. Half of Honor's 2016 valuation rule was vacated by the district court. It should have vacated the second half that relates to oil and gas valuation because it suffers from the same legal shortcomings. Starting with statute, the Mineral Leasing Act and the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act require a lessee to pay royalty on a specified percentage of the amount or value of production. The statute doesn't define value of production, but in the decades since those statutes were adopted, over 100 years now from the Mineral Leasing Act, the agency and federal courts have imposed sideboards on the meaning of value of production. And one of those key sideboards, one of the guiding principles of royalty valuation, is value of production means value at the lease. And we're not talking marketable condition.
I'm not sure about that. the guiding rule seems to be in federal royalty law that it's the marketable value. And the marketable value is determined, well, the cost to make it marketable are not deducted from the sale price in determining what the royalty is. And the general rule seems to be anything that the producer has to do to make this marketable, including moving the product, is not deductible. Just like the drilling costs. I mean, the big costs are the drilling. That's what you're really paying to get the product. You can't subtract the cost of drilling. You also can't subtract the cost of getting the product to a place where it can be made marketable. And are there contrary cases on that? It seems to me that you have cases, including one by Chief Justice Roberts when he was on the D.C. Circuit, suggesting that that's not deductible.
You have it partially right, Your Honor.
Good. Oh, that's a good
start. That's more than it usually is.
Thank you.
So-called gathering costs. So if you have a bunch of wells on a lease or a couple of neighboring leases, the cost of gathering production to a central facility to compress it and then move it on down the line, those gathering costs are not
because they're costs required to make the product marketable.
Correct.
But so why isn't
not what we're talking about here.
Right.
We're talking about is if the lessee incurs costs to now move that production to market, the case law is very clear, the rule says it. You are entitled to a deduction for the cost of that transportation.
Right, after it's marketable.
Correct.
But if you have to transport it to get it to be marketable, that's not deductible.
You don't always have to transport it to make it marketable. You may be able to sell the production to your lease for $45.
Right.
Okay? If you can move it closer to market and sell it for $52 and it costs you $5 to get there,
That's great.
You need to do that, but you're entitled to that $5 deduction because that's a transportation cost. So you need to start with the value where the gas or the oil was sold, and then you have to take value back to the lease because that is what the lessor is entitled to.
Well, let's take Judge Roberts' opinion. I'm terrible at names, but you know the case I'm referring to when Chief Justice was on the D.C. Circuit. There was gas that had a high carbon dioxide content, but it was marketable at the wellheads or on the property. Transporting that to a more distant place where it could be marketed was deductible for the most part. But when transporting that gas, you had to, before it could be marketed later on, 70% or something of the carbon dioxide had to be removed. So the court held that transporting that gas, the 70% of carbon dioxide that couldn't be marketed down the road, that was not a deductible cost. So even though it had to go a long way to get to market, it wasn't marketable, that 70% carbon dioxide. You know the case I'm talking about. Tell me how you handle it.
That's an entirely different issue. So you're entitled to a transportation allowance for moving the products on which you have to pay royalty.
Right.
So that if there are impurities in there, if there's excess water, if there's CO2 that's not marketable, you can't claim a transportation allowance for those products. We're talking about the transportation allowance for the product that's marketable, the oil or gas that's sold away from the lease. And ever since 1946 in the General Petroleum decision, where the court held that you're entitled to a transportation allowance, that has been the rule. It was adopted in the first transportation allowance regulations by the Minerals Management Service in 1988. It was finally codified, and that has always been the standard. And the agency here, for the first time, has stepped away from that guiding principle.
When you say that's always, what about the Kerr-McGee case?
Kerr-McGee involved a situation where there was movement among relatively adjacent leases. It was across a lease line. And that's, again, not what we're talking about here.
But it was off lease.
And gathering can be off lease.
Okay. And how far was it transported in that case? It was a couple
months. Well, leases are 640 acres. And let's talk about an outer continental shelf when we put gas leases.
No, but did the reasoning in the Kerr-McGee case in determining that this was gathering cost as opposed to transportation cost, did they talk about this not being very far off lease? Was that ever part of the reasoning of the case?
No, it was not, Your Honor. Well, and what we're talking isn't that
troublesome for you?
No, because some of these distances are considerable distances.
You just conceded that Kerr-McGee analysis didn't depend on the fact that it was close to the lease.
That's right, because then it's gathering. But we're not talking about gathering, we're talking about transportation. Gathering is a marketable condition cost, the lessee incurs that. Transportation is a deduction that it's entitled to.
But
because otherwise, the lessor is being unjustly enriched by the lessee incurring the cost to move its production downstream to the market.
Am I wrong when I state my understanding that gathering costs aren't deductible because they're necessary to make the product marketable?
Yes, but those
are... So why? What's the difference in principle between going a couple miles off the lease, I think it was a matter of a couple miles in Kerr-McGee, maybe I'm wrong, and doing it 50 miles in your cases?
Because, again, there is a distinction between gathering, and so you have a bunch of wells, you gather it relatively short distance to a central point, then you put it in a transportation line, a bigger pipeline, because those gathering lines, they're little pipes. You put it in a big pipeline and you start moving it down the market. Gathering is not deductible. Transportation is. And to the extent that this rule deprives the lessee of its transportation costs, it's invalid. It violates guiding principles of royalty valuation law.
Well, I just wanted to follow up. I didn't want to talk over you, but I wanted to follow up on Judge Hartz's question about Kerr-McGee. Because as I understand it, the IBLA was saying that it is gathering because from the wellhead to the first surface platform to on lease or to an adjacent lease is is to make the gas marketable. It is to treating it. And what I really have never understood about either side's position is, now they extrapolate from Kerr-McGee and say, well, because the rescission of the deepwater policy is to comply with Kerr-McGee, but I assume that in a subsea manifold or some a pipeline that is 200 meters or more undersea, that there can be gas or oil that is treated, and I assume that sometimes it's not treated.
It can't be treated. That's the whole issue. Deepwater production is a whole different process. It was cutting edge technology that never had been.
So you're saying that for a subsea pipeline and a subsea manifold, there cannot be treatment in a subsea manifold.
There isn't treatment at this point in a subsea manifold. But what happens is the same kind of gathering that happens onshore from surrounding wells happens 200 meters, 600 meters, 1,000 meters below the surface. They're gathering the production from wells to this subsea manifold. And then they're moving it sometimes 50 miles to a host platform because you can't put a treatment platform on every release.
Can there be treatment in a subsea manifold?
There is not. No, they're not. Treatment takes.
Well, then why isn't it rational for the 2016 evaluation policy? Because the deepwater policy is predicated on the fact that a subsea manifold can constitute a central accumulation point.
What are you talking about? Accumulation, not treatment.
I thought a central accumulation point was from the wellhead to the central accumulation point is all gathering because all of that is considered encompassing treatment.
Treatment is for oil, removing basic sediment, water, for gas, you're getting rid of impurities like carbon dioxide or hydrogen, sulfur and other impurities. That's treatment. Though you need more sophisticated facilities to do that. You can't do that on the seafloor.
Can a subsea manifold constitute a central accumulation point?
Yes.
All right.
And that's the point. MMS at the time was the expert agency. And the distinction was, at that time, 1999, not only was MMS responsible for royalty valuation, they regulated offshore leasing and operations. That's not the case now. That's been separated. But at the time, the expert agency looked at this issue, it considered whether it needed to change the rule and specifically treat that movement from the subsea manifold 50 miles to a host platform as transportation, and it decided it didn't. It could do it through a policy, but the condition in that policy was it had to be more than movement to an adjacent lease, any of the 8 leases touching the lease where the production occurred. So it had to be substantial movement, at least 3 miles, because OCS leases are 3x3. And so the expert agency determined that that was adequate to nominate that movement from the subsea manifold to the host platform as transportation. And the agency now, Honor, which no longer has the technical expertise, has said, you know what, we're going to change the rule and we're going to say that that's not transportation. But it was transportation before, and they nowhere explain, either in the rule or in the administrative record, what changed. And this was in effect for 17 years.
Don't they say what changed was just the need to incentivize it? Wasn't that where it came from in the first place? And they felt that it was no longer needed to incentivize it?
Royalty rules and policies are not intended to make decisions on incentivizing production. That's the leasing agency. But the purpose hasn't been fulfilled. Basically, the agency said to the lessees, if you invest the hundreds of millions and billions of dollars in developing these deep water cutting-edge leases, we're going to give you an allowance for the cost of moving that production to the host platform. And it's going to take decades for them to recover that because you make the investment up front, and then you're producing and transporting for decades after that. And now they're saying, you know what, we're going to cut it off because it no longer fulfills its purpose. Well, it may not fulfill the purpose to them, but it certainly there's a purpose for the lessee that it needs to recover its investment that it understood it was entitled to.
First, don't pay attention to the clock. There are too many issues here for us to discuss. You're going to be here a while, I suspect. So, because we need to understand this.
And I like to understand it. It's important.
But you didn't put on any evidence of reliance and the cost of reliance here. I think the agency found like $5 million a year would be the extra cost of this transportation.
About 20 to 25.
20 to 25, okay.
Yeah.
That's
there were different numbers in
the okay. But how, what evidence did you put on to show the reliance costs? Because in general, the fact that you relied on an agency decision in the past doesn't preclude the agency from changing its rules. But perhaps that's not true here when I understood this differently from what you said. I thought what Judge Bacharach indicated, which was that these deductions for transportation were intended to incentivize deep sea drilling. Let's assume that was the case. In this context, that helps you, I think. How were you misled to, I mean, you got to produce for a number of years already. I think royalties have been waived for most of the production there anyway through other provisions in the leases. How were your members hurt here?
Well, API did include in its comments exactly what I explained, that you know, part of, it may not be a big part, but a part of making decisions on how much you're going to bid for a lease, for example. You need to know what your costs are going to be. What are my royalty costs? Because am I going to bid $10 million to get this lease, or am I going to bid $20 million? And so you need to know what the rules are going to be when you make that bonus bid to get the lease in the first place. And that's where it comes into play. And so, you know, the agency puts up the lease for bid. It says, here are the rules on royalty. And so we got, you know, the prospective lessee figures out how much royalty it's going to pay over the life of this lease. And part of its calculation was, we're going to be able to deduct our transportation costs to that host platform that's 50 miles away from our lease. And now, Honor said, well, we're not going to get
well,
that.
But if other provisions in the lease have resulted in you're not having to pay any royalties, because there are lots of credits, I gather, for this production, then it really doesn't matter whether you can deduct your transportation costs because you're not paying royalties anyway. Is there anything in the record that calculates the extent to which the reliance interests of the producers was substantially violated?
Well, the Deepwater royalty relief that Congress granted, that was an incentive. So when Congress said, we will not make you pay any royalty on an initial volume, there was a cap put on that value. And that certainly was an incentive.
And that, has that cap been reached?
In a lot of cases, yes. Because that was only for leases that were issued between 1996 and 2000. After that, it was discretionary, and there's been some relief granted. But now most of those early leases are in royalty payment status, and now they're recouping some of their costs through this allowance. But it's not only about the dollars, it's about the principle. The principle is...
Well, the principle you lose on, because the principle, as the Supreme Court said, reliance interests on a prior agency decision do not preclude an agency from changing its rules. You've got to show some harm. It's not,
no,
the fact that you're offended in principle is not enough.
That's not the principle I'm referring to.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're P-A-L?
No, yeah. the principle I'm referring to is that value at the lease means you're entitled to deduct your transportation costs. And the agency cannot take that away from you in a regulation. The agency in 1999 said this is transportation. You get to deduct it. Now Honor is saying, well, it's not transportation. Well, we're going to call it gathering.
Does it matter how they said it? They said it in a guidance document. Isn't that right?
Yes, they did, Your Honor. But
it wasn't in a regulation. It wasn't in an adjudicatory determination. That's entitled to a lot less reliance than a guidance is entitled to a lot less reliance than these other types of decisions, isn't it?
But at the time, the agency explained that it was in the process of doing new rulemaking. It was the 2000, what became the 2000 oil rule. And MMS considered whether it needed to go ahead and make a regulatory change in order to give these lessees the transportation allowance for this transportation. And it decided, no, we don't need to change the rules. We can just explain it's transportation so long as you're moving it more than 3 miles or 3+ miles, because you got to get at least 2 leases away. You can't just move it to your neighboring lease. And so that was the only condition they put on it, and the only condition they needed to put on it. And that policy was in effect for 17 years. It wasn't challenged when it was issued. For years and years and years, that was the rule. And the agency basically at whim now is saying, no, we're going to call this gathering.
Can I ask you about that? Because with the guidance, and you talk about the dichotomy between transportation and gathering, and rightly or wrongly, I've been thinking about this as a dichotomy based on what is a central accumulation point versus what is not a central accumulation point, because that seems to me the focal point of the 1999 guidance. Movement prior to a central accumulation point is considered gathering, and it says then that that a central accumulation point can be a variety of things, including a subsea manifold.
Right.
And it sounds like you agree with that. Yes. Obviously, you agree with that. But I had been assuming that a central accumulation point is the end point from where the treatment takes place. What is a central accumulation point if it's not that?
A central accumulation point, again, you have individual wells. And then it's inefficient to build treatment facilities for every single well. So you accumulate. And
can there be treatment after the oil or gas is gathered at a central accumulation point?
Yes. And that's where it is usually treated. The distinction here is that usually it is treated at the central accumulation point or nearby. The deep water OCS was different. You're sometimes in thousands of feet of water, and the agency didn't want to put platform facilities on every lease out there because that's got environmental consequences. It's also enormously expensive. Those facilities in the deep water OCS cost over $1 billion each to build. And so the industry came up with this technology that will move it to these manifolds, okay, where it's accumulated, and then we're going to transport it to this host platform, which is getting production from multiple different manifolds all throughout this whole region of the deepwater outer continental shelf, and we'll treat it there because that's efficient and it makes sense. And what MMS said at the time is that makes sense to us. We're going to treat the deep water OCS differently.
And once it leaves, the oil or gas leaves the central accumulation point, it is continuing to be treated, and by definition, it wouldn't have been deemed marketable until it's been treated, correct?
In the general context of gathering, but again, the deep water OCS was recognized by MMS both as the royalty management agency and as the regulator of OCS operations and leasing as requiring a different set of standards.
Okay, you may have answered my question, but
I'm just trying to clarify. I think all you're saying is it didn't really qualify as gathering costs under the traditional view of what a gathering cost is, but they made this exception. And I think it's for the reasons to incentivize it and to get the get the development going, and now they've changed their mind and said, well, yes, we did make that exception. It still really is a gathering cost. We made this exception for a while for these purposes, but now we're not going to do that anymore. We don't think we need that incentive anymore. Now we're going to call it what it really was in the first place, which is a gathering cost. Right? Isn't that kind of what happened?
Almost.
I mean, that...
But close. But you know, onshore, where this all came up, you know, originally, gathering is neighboring leases. It's very short distances. The distinction here is you're moving at 50 miles. You're not just bringing it in from, you know, various points in downtown Denver. You're moving it to Boulder. And so the agency said, we recognize this is different than the traditional case. They could have done a different, you know, a new rulemaking. They decided they didn't need to do that at the time. And so their interpretation was their existing rule recognized this as transportation and not gathering, and therefore was deductible. And now they're just, you know, again, Honor, which is only a royalty collector. They don't have the expertise on the OCS to look at this, and they didn't include anything in the record showing that anything has changed or that the technology has changed or things are different than in 1999. And that's the inadequacy in their analysis. It doesn't exist. And they don't have the capability to do
it. Well, what's different is if what they say is, what they've offered is that they no longer need to incentivize it because it's happening. It's out there. The development's been done. And that's what's changed. And that's what the reason that they're giving for making this change now. So, I mean...
But royalty policy is not...
It's a good reason.
...is not designed to incentivize or disincentivize production. That's over in a different office where they make decisions on...
So your argument is that's not a valid... It's not a good reason. It's
not a valid argument.
Did you have some?
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So, but I'm not trying to beat a dead horse, but I want to make sure that I understand your answer to my last question. So, starting with a predicate of what you focused on at the start, valuation of the lease. So, if there's say 12.5, percent of whatever the oil or gas that is, you know, produced at the wellhead or the subsea manifold, whatever it is. To determine that value, it has to be put in a marketable condition before you start attaching that 12.5%, right?
Agreed.
And so from the subsea wellhead or manifold, if it's treated in a subsea pipeline to a platform or to another subsea wellhead or whatever it is. All, as long as it's being treated, all of that is, whether we call it gathering or something other than the responsibility, you know, to, all of that is gathering. Even under your view, right?
Well.
Until it is marketable.
But again, you have to look at what gathering meant. And you look at California Company versus Udall. And that was the first case, 1961 DC Circuit. They said, you gotta compress it, you gotta dehydrate it, you have to remove impurities. They said, but we're not talking about transportation. But they did talk about gathering.
Okay, but whether you call it gathering or, you know, whatever, X, it's not marketable until the treatment has been completed, correct?
In the deep water context, it's different because, again, you can't put treatment facilities on every lease 2,000 feet below the water.
Well,
or build a platform.
Like devil's advocate, that's what they're saying. And so that's why they're saying, as I understand it, well, deep sea production is different. And what you're saying, the value at the lease head, or value at the lease, has to be post completion or at the point of completion of the treatment and
the completion of the gathering.
The gathering, and they say that, well,
okay.
Yeah,
because we're talking only difference between gathering and transportation. We're not talking about treatment.
Okay.
So MMS in 1999 said, bringing the production from multiple wells to one of these subsea manifolds, that's gathering. But from the manifold to that host facility 50 miles away, it's transportation.
Okay. I understand it now, and thank you both for your indulgence.
I'm going to give you a little more time. The briefs were helpful to me, at least, on both sides. But I'll give you 5 minutes if there's some on another issue that you would, you think it's important to bring to our attention.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Thank you. So one of the other provisions in this rule is there's a cap of 50% of the transportation cost. If you cap transportation costs, you can't be providing the full transportation cost. Under the 1988 rule, there was a cap, but there was also a provision that said you could exceed the cap if you could demonstrate that your reasonable actual cost exceeded 50%. So it was, you know, it was a check. But now the agency is saying 50%, that's it. And what's particularly problematic is the year before they did a rule for Indian oil valuation, and in that rule they considered a cap, and they said we can't do this because it violates the concept that you have to provide the transfer, the full reasonable actual transportation costs to the lessee. And when you consider that the secretary owes the highest trust duty to Native Americans and didn't adopt that provision for an Indian rule, but then 1 year later adopts it for a federal rule, that inconsistency is just not legally supportable under the controlling case law. There's another provision that is problematic. So API supports index pricing, and this is the first rule that's providing index pricing for gas. But what it says is that if you sell your gas and there's a local index price, you have to pay royalty on that index price. But if there is another index price that you theoretically could get, so let's say it's $2.75 where you sold it, and you got $2.75, you got the index price. But there's an index price in another market that's $3. And there happens to be a pipeline that goes from where you are to that market. But that pipeline's full. You could not physically get your gas into that pipeline. Otter is saying, you've got to use that higher $3 value. That makes absolutely no sense, because the market where the production occurred was $2.75, and now saying that there are theoretical markets, but that you can't actually get to, that establish a higher value, it is, again, an unprincipled standard that departs from valuation of the lease. Another provision in the regulations has to do with fixed adjustments to those index prices. So, you know, the indexes are at the market centers, and you know, the leases are not always at the market center. So you got to move your gas from your lease to the market center. Instead of doing an actual cost calculation, what the rule allows is a fixed adjustment. And that adjustment is 5% of the index price on the outer continental shelf and 10% everywhere else in the United States. Everywhere. In its comments, API said, well, you know, first of all, you know, what is your justification for that? We think these numbers are fairly low. And that 5% and 10%, that had been adopted in an Indian valuation 17 years earlier. So again, API said, you know, where is the explanation of how this is still a currently sensible rule? And the agency's response was, well, we studied transportation cost data, and it supports what we did. That transportation cost analysis is not in the preamble. It's not in the administrative record. And so when you know, these fixed adjustments that are now applied around the nation on the California outer continental shelf and, you know, in Colorado and on the lease in Alabama, without any explanation of why these are still reasonable, just makes no sense. If I could just take one more minute to talk about remedy. This rule has a lot of problems, and our view is the entire rule should be vacated. But There are several of these segregable provisions, including the ones I talked about this morning, that could be vacated, and the rest of the rule could remain intact. So what we would urge this court to do is to vacate the entire rule, but at a minimum, look at these provisions that are particularly problematic that we addressed in our briefing, and vacate those provisions, and then have the agency go back and revisit those issues.
Just the transportation allowance issues.
It's the transportation allowance issues. It's the index. You know, this index, this unattainable index.
That too is severable.
That's severable, right? Because it could just say use your local index price. You don't have to go to an index, 100 miles away, even though there's a pipeline that you can't get into. There are other issues, the written contract issue that we addressed.
I want to ask about that. What's so hard about having written contracts? The response was it doesn't have to be in writing. It could be electronic. Why is that a problem?
Well, two responses. First, there's an incongruity in the rule. They shoved that provision into the rule, but they didn't change their definition of a contract as being an oral or written agreement that's enforceable at law.
But what they want is something in writing to confirm the terms so they can be confident that this was really the agreement. And what's so hard about that?
What's hard about that is that in today's world, with electronic transactions happening instantaneously, there isn't time to send a DocuSign document that you fill out.
Do you not have standard documents? And so if you're doing something in the spot market, you're doing it with someone, you've done it before, and there's a contract that always covers it?
They tend to be after the fact affirmations. And I'm not an oil and gas trader, so I can't give you all of the details of it. But that's the concern, is you can't have what we all would consider a written and signed agreement before the transaction occurs. It's just not a manageable process in today's marketplace.
I think you might have to give us more before we could say that the regulation is arbitrary on that basis, but okay. I was curious about that. Did you have a question?
No.
I hope you feel you've been heard.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to answer your questions because they were important. And I still have my 2 minutes after.
Well,
I
no, no, no. We'll say
that. Good try.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Michelle Nelson on behalf of the federal government. Before we get to the specific issues in the case, I'd like to emphasize three background points about HONOR's, that's the Office of Natural Resources Revenue, referred to as HONOR, about HONOR's work. First, HONOR processes just an absolutely enormous volume of reported data. Industry submits more than 550,000 reports every month, and in fiscal year 2021, there were more than 7 million reports. Verifying these reports can be incredibly labor-intensive and require significant technical expertise. The agency has to go back through many, often quite sophisticated and complex contracts. It has to verify that the lessee actually received what the contract said that they did. It has to determine whether costs were properly unbundled and allocated. And it has to understand and apply the regulations to each of these often unique circumstances. This is a fact-specific and time-consuming process. Additionally, the agency's regulations have to accommodate a wide variety of business practices, industry developments, and frankly, but lacking a better term, I call anomalous situations. How oil and gas is produced and marketed and sold is constantly evolving, and the regulations have to be expansive enough to not be immediately obsolete. HONOR's regulations have to fit producers in West Texas, whose oil is light and sweet, and who can take advantage of some of the most dense pipeline infrastructure in the world and some of the most sophisticated and deep markets. But the regulations also have to accommodate oil and gas produced in isolated fields with only a single producer. In sum, HONOR administers a vast and highly technical operation, And with this context in mind, it makes sense that the agency sought in amending its valuation rules in 2016 to provide clarity, consistency, certainty, and simplicity for both the lessee and for the agency. API raises a host of issues with Honor's 2016 rule, but these boil down to whether the agency was arbitrary and capricious when it promulgated the rule. API compares the 2016 valuation rule unfavorably with the prior regulations put in place in 1988. They're obviously entitled to their view, but their interest was not the only one that the agency had to consider. With respect to all of the issues that API challenges here, in fact, the agency received comments from various stakeholders, not all of whom agreed with the industry's perspective, and in fact, some of whom vociferously disagreed with their views. The agency was not required to accept the views of any of these stakeholders uncritically. In some cases, Honor did accept the views of industry. In others, it accepted the views of the states, who have equitable interests and financial interests here and are represented here today by counsel. And still others, it charted a middle path, accepting neither side entirely. The agency was entitled to use its best judgment, and it did that here in the 2016 rule. The agency's choices were reasonable and adequately explained in the record, and the APA requires nothing more. I want to touch briefly on this issue of valuation at the lease.
Before you go further, you're dividing your argument.
I'm sorry, I should have said that at the outset. Yes, I am going to try to reserve 5 minutes for interveners.
Okay, but you're going to discuss all the issues. I didn't want to ask you about one question if somebody else was going to address that.
Yes, I am going to address, and I can entertain any questions.
Okay.
Picking back up with valuation of the lease, the district court was right that there's little actual controversy about Honor's statutory authority to enact this regulation. And in fact, I heard counsel this morning concede that the definition of value is undefined and broad under the statute. API attempts to single out one particular royalty principle, that of valuation of the lease, and elevate that to the status of unshakable legal requirement. That has never been the law. It is not the law by statute. None of the cases that they cite this proposition actually hold as much, and there's just simply no authority supporting that view.
Well, with regard to the deep sea policy, at least, I didn't understand the rationale for the rescission of the deep sea policy, the guidance, and the enactment of these regulations to be based on the idea that you are appending the principle of valuation at the lease. So at least on that issue, I don't know that you're arguing that you can defend the change based on some opposition to his valuation at the lease principle, right?
I'm not sure that I'm getting your Honor's question.
Well, does your defense on the rescission of the deep sea policy and on that issue is assuming that you do value at the lease.
That's correct, Your Honor. And in fact, on all of these issues, we maintain that we are upholding the principle of valuation at the lease, just that it is not an entirely unyielding and the only important principle. It has to yield in some cases, or at least be reconciled with principles that Your Honors were talking about earlier this morning, such as the principle that the lessee bears the cost for putting product into marketable condition.
What is a central accumulation point, and what is the impact? Practically speaking, what is it, and what is the significance of it?
Yes, thank you. A central accumulation point is what it sounds like, and I know that sounds amorphous. Counsel earlier was talking about it could be any point anywhere where there is accumulation. That is not the agency's view. The agency's view is that it is a central accumulation point, and each producer or lessee has a central accumulation point. It is not any accumulation point that it is not any place where two products merge. It is the central accumulation point on the lease or off the lease, as the case may be.
If there's treatment after gathering at the central accumulation point, can that be considered transportation?
The movement between the central accumulation point and
some other
treatment point?
Yeah.
I don't know the answer to that question. In terms of whether it's deductible at that point, I think...
Can ONRR... consider that a transportation and allow that to be a deduction?
I don't know the answer. Usually, and the reason I'm saying that I don't know the answer is that my understanding is that usually the central accumulation and treatment points are the same place.
So a subsea manifold can constitute a central accumulation point, right?
Only under the deep sea policy.
That's what I don't understand. So you rescind that and say, well, it can't be. It has to be a surface platform. Why? What is the magic of a manifold with multiple connection points for multiple pipes that can no longer be considered a central accumulation point? It has to be a surface platform. Why?
Well,
other than you all said
it. Long-standing views. And I do think that is reflected in the Kerr-McGee decision. It's also reflected in the Nexen decision, which discusses Kerr-McGee and the agency's long-standing position. The agency could say, as it did in the deepwater policy, that a central, that a subsea manifold is a central accumulation point. But that doesn't mean that it necessarily is a central accumulation point. And the agency's views prior to the adoption of the deepwater policy and in this regulation, it is not properly considered a central accumulation point because, in their view, a central accumulation point is not any place, like I said, where the product meets.
But it seems that the agency did make special rules for the deepwater policy, and maybe it was to incentivize, but it seemed to be also very specialized based on the particular circumstances of that situation. And how do you just how is it not arbitrary to simply say, well, you know what? Yeah, we changed our mind. Now we're kind of going back to Plan A, which was the way it was before. This is a gathering cost again. And just ignore all those special circumstances and the extra cost and the extra mileage.
Well, I don't think the agency ignored the special circumstances. I guess I would have two responses. First,
did it consider them?
I mean, certainly API and others raised those concerns. The agency did consider them. The agency responded and simply said, look, like, this is not something we need to do forever. It was a policy. It was put in place to incentivize production in ultra deep water. That has happened, and therefore
was that made clear by the agency early on that it was strictly that it was essentially a short term deal, in the sense that this is just to incentivize. We're gonna recognize these particular conditions that you have to deal with. We're gonna allow you to take the transportation cost for what's traditionally gathering cost, but oh by the way, this is just an incentive. This is not going to continue.
Was that
understood?
I think it was implicit in the fact that the agency did consider whether to amend its definition of gathering in the 2000 rulemaking, and it declined to do so. And, you know, you can counsel on the other side, or at least that means one thing. I don't find his view particularly persuasive. And I want to go back to Your Honor's original point about this being arbitrary. The agency said very clearly it wants to have consistent, clear, bright-line rules. The deepwater policy was not a bright-line rule, and in fact, as the agency said, when it initially proposed to rescind it, producers were taking advantage further and further and further into offshore waters in order to take transportation deductions. The agency was not arbitrary for the agency to say, not only enough, but we want clear and administrable rules. We want the rules of the road to be clear to everybody. We want this to be simple and administrable. And I would just point out, Council has many times said that, you know, this product moves long distances, and that is true, but they're still entitled to take deductions after the first platform. I mean, that is not on shore in most instances.
So they can create a platform, say, 100 feet from the subsea wellhead, and create a platform. Pipe goes to the surface platform. That's gathering, and then if it's transported, even with treatment in a pipe, in a surface platform, 1,000 miles, all of that will be deductible allowance.
Your Honor, I think it would, I think it would likely under the facts you suggest be allowable. It would also depend on what was happening on that platform, right? What kind of treatment, you know.
Well, you said I think the regulation says that it will be considered gathering until the gas or oil is transported to the first surface platform.
It is gathering for sure until that point. It may still be gathering after that point, but it depends on the particular circumstances on the lease and what happens to that product.
Okay, so
if it's made marketable at the platform, there's no question it's transportation after that.
I'm sorry, I missed the first part of that. Could you please repeat that?
I swallowed my words, I'm sorry. if it's made markable at this surface platform, then there's no question that after that it's transportation.
Correct. That's correct.
So is that the governing standard? Is once the treatment is completed and it is deemed marketable?
Yes, Your Honor.
So then why don't, you know, one of the questions that that the plaintiff has argued is, then why not rescind the deep sea policy and just say that on a case-by-case basis, you're going to determine when the gas or oil is deemed marketable, rather than to create this artificial demarcation at the point that it goes to the first platform. He gave a rhetorical question on page 10 of his reply brief that I do think sort of crystallizes sort of the anomaly to me of creating this artificial benchmark now based on the surface platform. It had been the subsea manifold, but I really don't understand what the magic is of making it based on the first surface platform.
I do want to answer Your Honor's question. I'm very sensitive to time as well. And I want to make... Okay. Thank you. It is not... So I know that it seems, coming to this fresh, as I did when I first started reading this, coming to this fresh, it does seem like the agency's regulation is unclear, but they have consistently applied it, and the rules have always been consistently applied. I understand why API wants to take these deductions, but just because they say that something is... transportation does not make it so. The agency has a long history of considering the kind of movement at issue that was accepted under the deep water policy to be gathering. To Your Honor's point about why make an arbitrary line, I do not agree that it is arbitrary. It is a bright line, and it is about the movement of bulk product. Bulk necessarily means untreated product. So they're just saying we're going to consider the first platform to possibly be a central accumulation point. But at that point, there is no treatment. Are there further questions from the... Okay. If there's no further questions from the court, I will let interveners... Thank you.
You're not going to respond to his complaints about other provisions?
I'm happy to, Your Honor. I'm very...
He had 35 minutes altogether, so...
Okay, just a few...
We might give you 16.
Thank you. Just a few quick points on the natural gas index point issue. You know, he says how it's completely ridiculous and arbitrary to force companies to base pricing through a pipeline that cannot be moved. Honor, once again, drew a very clear bright line and it said, if your pipe is connected and you can actually move regardless of pipeline constraints, if it can physically move to that point, that is the point you should use. And the reason for that is that Honor does not know whether on any particular day or any particular week, a particular pipeline segment is constrained. That information is not with the agency. It is trade secret in some cases. In some cases, it is it's in contracts between pipeline operators and lessees that the agency just does not have access to. And so that is why it said physical movement is what counts. I do not think that is arbitrary. It is about, as is much of this rule, administrability, right-line rules, and ensuring that the agency can do its job efficiently and effectively.
He also argues not only is it may it not be accessible, but it's arbitrary to use the highest bidweek index price, and it would have been more rational to use an average. What's wrong with that argument?
Well, I don't know why an average is less arbitrary in that sense than the highest. Because in price, the agency did do a cost compare. It said that the highest, let me back up.
It arguably it is arbitrary to say, or punitive to say, well, I'm going to just assume that you would have gotten the very highest price that any of the producers could have gotten.
Well, to be clear, actually, the agency had first considered doing a true-up at the end of the year, either gross proceeds or the high or the index price, and whichever one is higher is what we'll take. And industry said, no, we don't want that. And the agency did not do that. I mean, the highest bidweek price is a market value. The agency said it's usually going to be higher than gross proceeds, but for the data that it calculated, 3 of those months, gross proceeds were on average higher than the highest bidweek price. I mean, it is just an indicator of value. It is to protect the public's interest, and it is to protect the state's interest, who, by the way, they don't like index prices at all, and they urge the agency not to adopt them. And so this was, I think, a compromise position to protect the public's interest, and I do not think that is arbitrary. I do not think that the court probably has any questions about contracts, but I think Your Honor was completely correct that it is not arbitrary to require signatures. The agency needs to verify what is in the regulations. And I would just, on the transportation and processing caps, lessees have never been entitled, as we point out in our brief, as a right to take these. And therefore, if the question is whether it was ultra vires for the agency to do this, the answer is no.
No, but it was arbitrary.
It was not arbitrary.
There was no explanation except we have discretion, so we're going to change it.
That's what they said in the final rule. But if you look at the draft rule, they actually did provide an explanation. And I can give you the page number. That is on page 185 of the appendix. They said this is about administrability. It is very difficult, even if we get only 5 or 7 of these requests a year, it is very difficult for us to have, they basically have to do a full-blown audit to assess what these transportation and processing, if the transportation costs are necessary and reasonable. And that requires going back through, depending on what the lessee requests, up to 5-7 years of contracts and data to verify. And that is not a workflow that the agency controls because it happens when the lessee requests it. Honor consistently throughout this rule looked for ways to simplify its workload. It's truly enormous workload. And this was not, or it was a way for the agency to do that, to just say, you know what? Very few companies take this, but the few companies that do take this, it is very burdensome for us, it is very time consuming, and it is very difficult. We think that 50% is enough in most cases. And that was not an arbitrary decision.
Why was it not arbitrary to say, okay, well, it's just too much of a pain in the neck for these producers, but even though any of producers have not used this yet, if next year there are 5 requests to exceed the 50, 66.6 caps, you all can do that.
I'm sorry, did you mention the Indian rule or did I miss
your... I'm saying there is a difference in treatment.
Yes, there is a difference in treatment, and as the agency explained, there are 3 reasons for that difference in treatment. One, nobody ever asks in the Indian context.
Yeah, they can.
Right. They can, and we do not dispute that. Second, the rulemaking for the Indian oil price was a negotiated rulemaking, and that was not something that the committee recommending changes to the Indian oil rule recommended. And the agency said, third, we may take a look at that in the future. It has not been burdensome for us to date. But, you know, we may in the future, when there's not a negotiated rulemaking, or perhaps at some future negotiated rulemaking, we may change that. And so it did distinguish. My friends on the other side also raised coal as another distinction. Coal is just a completely different commodity. It's a solid commodity. The relative cost of shipping coal, because it is a solid commodity and it does not move along pipelines, it mostly moves by rail, are very high relative to the value of the commodity. So transportation costs in the coal context usually exceed 60% of the value of the product, and therefore there was never a rule about coal. So they're just, it's apples and oranges.
If sorry to belabor this, but if let's say the costs are 80%, it would undermine the whole concept of value at the least. I understand you argued at the outset that that's not, you know, cast in granite, but...
Well, they're free to sell their product at any point they want. I mean, if they, you know...
But if they're saying, I can't, there's nobody that's going to buy it, you know, unless we have to, you know, transport it 60, 80 miles, and that's going to cause us to exceed this 50, 66.6 cap... And so we want that if we were talking about the actual value at the lease, and these, maybe it's a pain in the neck, but it's a pain in the neck that Congress articulated value at the lease.
Respectfully, Your Honor, Congress did not articulate that.
All right. But if we accept that the guiding principle for ONRR's adjustments were not predicated on appending the value at the lease concept, that you all have subscribed in proposing these changes to the valuation of the lease, let's just assume for purposes of my question, back to Judge Hartz's question, why isn't it arbitrary to say that for the actual value of the lease in these 2 or 3 situations that it does exceed the, you know, these caps, and maybe it's a really hard to do this, but you have to do what you have to do.
Well, I guess I would just proffer 2 answers. One, nothing forces the agency. And again, under the 1988 rules, nothing forced the agency. I mean, lessees could have come to Honor and said, please, our costs are 80%, we really need this. And the agency could have said no. In practical terms, like, I don't have the information about the need, how often the agency did say no, or whether they always said yes. That information is not in the record. But the idea that Honor cannot do this is just patently false. And moreover, like, if the idea is it violates the concept of value of the lease, Honor cares about valuation of the lease and upholds that, but it is not an unyielding principle. And if there are important administrative values like simplicity and managing the agency's workload that the agency is under the APA allowed to consider when it makes these rules.
Doesn't it violate the concept, though, of reasonable actual transportation costs that you do continue to allow them to deduct? Reasonable actual, and if their actual exceeds this percentage, why isn't it arbitrary to say, okay, you can have reasonable actual costs, and these are reasonable, but nevertheless, we have a cap. That seems kind of arbitrary.
I can see I'm not making much headway on this issue with your honors, but I can understand the point. Honor did say that in almost all cases, that is simply not the case. 50% is an adequate amount. A lot of states said you shouldn't be allowing transportation deductions at all.
Are you really saying that reasonable means whatever the cap is? I mean,
No. If the issue is the definitions define transportation allowances in one way, and in a specific regulatory text section, it says we're capping costs.
You don't get your actual costs.
No, but the definition is just what are transportation allowances, and then there's in the actual regs, it says, but we cap these at a certain amount. I do not see that as inconsistent. The more specific provision controls, and it's still saying any transportation costs you have to take. There are limitations on what you can take in terms of transportation costs. They must be actual and it must be reasonable and necessary.
Okay. I have questions on 2 points. You mentioned that the explanation for the cap was the administrative costs. That is mentioned in the preliminary.
The draft, yes.
The draft of the rule, but not in the final rule.
Well, in the final, they were just responding to people's comments. In the draft, they set forth their rationale, and then people provided comments, and they said they were responding, but nobody raised, well, I think it's not administrative. I mean, that was sort of the context in the final rule that they were discussing. That.
Okay. And there was one thing that Mr. Schomburg mentioned that I missed in the briefing, but he talked about some expense was set at 5% for outer continental shelf production, but 10% everywhere else.
Yes, and to be honest, Your Honor, I had not focused on that, and I'm not. I'm happy to submit a letter to the court discussing that. I don't believe that we discussed that. I'm not sure whether he's talking about natural gas index price deduction.
I thought that was the default.
Okay. Right. So essentially, let me just back. I can respond. For natural gas, in the natural gas index method, Honor says you have to use the high bid week price at a place to which your gas could physically flow, even if the pipeline is constrained at a particular moment in time. But in order to, like, account for transportation, we are going to give you a standard deduction, 5% or 10%.
From the index?
From the index price.
But the standard deduction is only half as much for outer continental shelf production as for everywhere else. Is that correct?
I'm actually not entirely sure what the specific provisions are on that, but I'd be happy to. But even if that was the case, I think it's producers are always permitted to trace their actual gross proceeds and deduct their reasonable transportation costs. The index price is not meant to be an actual measure of it is meant to be a measure of value that is approximate.
Well, they said it was based on their own, the agency said it was based on their calculations, but the calculations don't appear in any public record. That seems problematic to me. If they're going to argue that this is because this deduction fits with the difference in transportation costs or whatever in these two production areas, can they just say that without providing any data to support it?
I am really not familiar enough with the niche specifics of this particular, this like sub-provision, and I would really appreciate the opportunity to submit a letter to the court on this issue.
Promptly.
I will, thank you.
And how much time did you want for your...
5 minutes, if that's possible. Thank you, Your Honor. We ask that you affirm.
They're each going to, okay.
Thank you, Your Honors. I may have pleased the court. I'm Tom Zimbleman. I'm with the Natural Resources Defense Council. I represent the environmental group interveners in this case. And together with my co-counsel, Mr. Torian from the state of California and Mr. Grantham from the state of New Mexico, we were interveners in the district court and appellees in this court. I realize that we are already over time, so I'll try to keep my remarks brief. What I want to emphasize is the agency's statutory responsibility to ensure that states and the public receive a fair return for leasing that occurs on public land, and the relevance of that responsibility as the agency updates its valuation provisions. So the valuation rule was a much-needed update to make responsible changes to the agency's royalty valuation process, and this court should affirm the oil and gas provisions as the district court did. So both the Mineral Leasing Act and the Outer Continental Shelf Leasing Act prescribe a minimum royalty rate. It was 12.5%. It's since been raised in some contexts in the Inflation Reduction Act to 16.67%. And that is all that the statutes say in terms of how production is to be valued. You know, other principles derive from HONOR's rulemakings, but HONOR can change those provided that it complies with the APA when it does so. Under law, this is in 30 U.S.C. Section 191, half of the royalties that are collected for oil and gas leasing go to the state within which that oil and gas leasing occurs. On an annual basis, that can mean tens of millions of dollars for the state of California. New Mexico has a significantly more oil and gas leasing, so that can mean over $1 billion in some years for the state of New Mexico. Both states use those proceeds to support public education. Other critical priorities are funded at the federal level. So, for instance, the Land and Water Conservation Fund is financed through offshore oil and gas royalties, and that pays for conservation and improvements on public land. So the agency has to consider these responsibilities to the public and ensure that the public is earning a fair return. We cited the D.C. Circuit's decision in California Company versus Udall, which is a 1961 decision evaluating the marketable condition rule, but the court observed there, the point of the Mineral Leasing Act is not just to permit oil and gas development at any price, it is to ensure that the public earns a fair return. And then Congress reinforced that obligation in the Federal Oil and Gas Royalty Management Act of 1982, and that statute directs the Department of the Interior to have a comprehensive auditing, enforcement, and compliance process, and to ensure that the agency is promptly collecting and dispersing oil and gas royalties. So Ms. Melton emphasized that this rule is there to provide consistency and clarity and simplicity in the administration of this program. I would argue that is a policy consideration that Congress has directed the agency to take into account through provisions like the Federal Oil and Gas Royalty Management Act and its directive to promptly collect and disperse oil and gas royalties. I think also just to refer to one thing in the record, and again, I appreciate the court indulging this argument, we're already over time. Ms. Melton mentioned there are two areas in which the states had urged the agency to go further than it did. Both of those are discussed in the State and Tribal Royalty Audit Committee letter, which was included in the supplemental appendix that we filed along with our brief. The first of those was on the issue of the transportation caps. And the point that the states made with respect to transportation caps is that they're quite generous, which would be demonstrated by the fact that HONOR doesn't see a lot of requests to exceed them. They were set a long time ago, and in situations in which they are too generous, they don't give lessees a proper incentive to reduce costs. And in turn, that deducts from the royalty revenue that states and the general public are entitled to under these statutes. So they have the agency actually to revisit where it sets the caps, using the agency's discretion to define what is a reasonable transportation cost that can be deducted from royalty revenue. And the agency declined to make that change, But I think that that provides some support for the change the agency ultimately did make, which was to observe that these caps are quite generous, they accommodate the vast majority of situations, and that using the agency's authority to prescribe reasonable costs.
That did the ONRR give that in the 2016 evaluation rule as part of the explanation?
They did respond to that particular observation in the final rule. Yes, Your Honor.
They said part of the reason that we're going to abrogate the caps is to remove the is to create an incentive for producers to reduce their expenses.
No, Your Honor. I don't believe the agency said that in the rule. I think what they said was that the caps accommodate the vast majority of situations and so are reasonable. They did respond to the observation that they don't provide a proper incentive to reduce costs, that that cuts into royalty revenue, by acknowledging that comment and then saying that they weren't going to revisit where they had set the caps at this time. So they did provide a response there. And then the second issue, which Ms. Melton alluded to briefly, was on the index-based pricing option. So there, again, this is in the State and Tribal Royalty Audit Committee letter. There were reservations expressed about that proposal based on the potential that market prices could be artificially manipulated so that the published price may be lower in some instances than what states would have received under gross proceeds. So the state proposal was that states should be allowed to opt in to the use of the index-based pricing method in the same way that the lessee is. So it's not just a sort of one-way decision. There again, the agency explained that it wasn't going to make that change. It explained why it didn't see the same potential for manipulation. It did that in response to that particular comment letter. But it also explained selecting the highest bid-weed price is there to protect the interests of the federal lessor. And that in turn protects the state's interest in royalty revenue as well. The highest bid-weed price continues to be market-based. It resets frequently, so it's not a stale price, and it's there to protect the interests of the federal and state lessor, which, you know, under this statutory scheme, is not an improper reason for selecting that particular price point. The public is entitled to a fair return for leasing on federal lands. Again, I thank the court for indulging me as we are over time, and then thank you so much for your attention.
Thank you. Ms. Schoenberg, 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a few points. On the hard caps, if you all recall, a year and a half or 2 years ago, oil prices dropped dramatically to single digits and even went negative. If you have a $5 contract to transport your gas your oil, and oil selling for $50, cap's not an issue. But if that oil price drops to $8, that cap's now an issue, and it is going to be a big problem for that time frame. When the oil prices collapse. And they haven't audited that time period yet, but it's gonna come up. On central accumulation point, I just wanna make clear, the agency has the rulemaking pen. They could have defined central accumulation point. They didn't. To my knowledge, neither BLM for onshore leases nor BSEE for offshore leases has defined central accumulation point. So you see this in this gathering rule, but it's a rather imprecise concept. And Ms. Melton said that, you know, it was API who said that this was transportation from the subsea manifold to the first platform. No, it wasn't. It was the expert agency. It was MMS, which again, then at the time, had both the royalty and the operational expertise. Their comment that you can get an allowance from that distant platform to shore, that's irrelevant. It has nothing to do with whether you're entitled to an allowance from that subsea manifold to the platform. We pointed that out in our brief, and I just wanted to reemphasize that. On the highest bid week price,
you're almost done.
Okay.
Finish your sentence.
The Indian rules, they don't even go to highest bid-week price, and the Secretary owes a fiduciary duty to maximize royalty revenues for Indians, but not for the federal government.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Counsel. Case is submitted. Counsel are excused. Court is adjourned, right, Chris? Court's adjourned.
Thank you.